for those of you who may be new, we are working our way through the Bible, roughly one book at a time, not necessarily in order. Today we're going to have a look at the book of Joshua, and if you want to read ahead for next week, you can read 1 Samuel. Over the next year or so, we will eventually face up to every corner of God's Word. So what's Joshua about in a nutshell? Well, it's about God's divine judgment on the Canaanites. That's one half of it. And the other half is God's grace to Israel. So it's divine judgment and grace. And that's the message that I want you to take away from the book of Joshua. We're going to have a look at a number of different aspects of it, but that's the main point. Context. Well, we've been through the Pentateuch, or the Torah, or the first five books of the Bible, written largely by Moses. And so we get to Joshua. Joshua is distinct from the Torah in that there's no new law. There's no law that's given in Joshua. And Joshua tends to be a very forward-looking book rather than one that simply recounts the past. It looks forward. Who is Joshua? Well, 40 years prior to the events of the book of Joshua, as recounted in Numbers chapter 13, Joshua was one of the spies that was sent out to check out the promised land. Joshua had been born in Egypt, and he and another guy called Caleb recommended that they go and take the promised land. He said, "We can do it." But they gave what we would call a minority report. There were 12 spies, and only two of them said, "Yes, we can do it." The other 10 argued that Israelites were too weak. And unlike Joshua and Caleb, they weren't trusting in the fact that it was God who was going to do the fighting for them. They said that the Israelites were too weak for this. And hence, God brought judgment on them. And 40 years later, it was only Joshua and Caleb who were going to see the promised land. And Joshua was going to be the one to lead the people into it. So that's who Joshua is. So what's the wider context of this book? What's the rest of the story so far? Well, it just so happens that Joshua himself gives us a rundown in his own words in chapter 24, verses 1 to 15. Then Joshua assembled all the tribes of Israel at Shechem. He summoned the elders, leaders, judges and officials of Israel, and they presented themselves before God. Joshua said to all the people, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Long ago your ancestors, including Terah, the father of Abraham and Nahor, lived beyond the Euphrates River and worshipped other gods. But I took your father Abraham from the land beyond the Euphrates and led him throughout Canaan and gave him many descendants. I gave him Isaac, and to Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. I assigned the hill country of Seir to Esau, but Jacob and his family went down to Egypt. Then I sent Moses and Aaron, and I afflicted the Egyptians by what I did there, and I brought you out. When I brought your people out of Egypt, you came to the sea, and the Egyptians pursued them with chariots and horsemen as far as the Red Sea. But they cried out to the Lord, for help, and he put darkness between you and the Egyptians. He brought the sea over them and covered them. You saw with your own eyes what I did to the Egyptians. Then you lived in the wilderness for a long time. I brought you to the land of the Amorites who lived east of the Jordan. They fought against you, but I gave them into your hands. I destroyed them from before you, and you took possession of their land. When Balak, son of Zippor, the king of Moab, prepared to fight against Israel, he sent for Balaam, son of Beor, to put a curse on you. But I would not listen to Balaam, so he blessed you again and again, and I delivered you out of his hand. Then you crossed the Jordan and came to Jericho. The citizens of Jericho fought against you, as did also the Amorites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hittites, Girgashites, Hivites, and Jebusites. But I gave them into your hands. I sent the hornet ahead of you, which drove them out before you. Also the two Amorite kings. You did not do it with your own sword and bow. So I gave you a land on which you did not toil, and cities you did not build, and you live in them, and eat from vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant. Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. throw away the gods your ancestors worshipped beyond the Euphrates River and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. Now back in Genesis chapter 15, verse 16, God referred to the time that we're going to have a look at in the book of Joshua, when he said this to Abraham: in the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. Amorites and Canaanites were terminologies that were interchangeable to a certain extent. Now, the key passage that sets the scene of all of this is God's promise to Abraham just a little while earlier in chapter 12, Genesis chapter 12, 1-3, God's promise to Abraham. The Lord said to Abraham, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." Now, there's various facets of Genesis, and in focusing on the promise to Abraham, we don't want to lose sight of the other key elements of Genesis, such as the creation and the fall, and the fact that it was in Egypt that the people of Israel were transformed from a family into a nation. But for the purposes of our travels through Joshua and beyond, Genesis 12 is the central point. Here's a few key points from Joshua. The timing of it was related to the sin of the Canaanites. That's what God had said. Next is that Israel were God's people and he was their God. That's a key thing. Israel's entry into the land had been delayed 40 years due to rebellion. And this is the beginning of the history of Israel in the homeland. And as you'll see, as I read there earlier, Joshua is challenging the people about their devotion to God. And we'll talk about that again later and their positive response to that. But unfortunately, the land is eventually taken away in 2 Kings. We read about that in fulfillment of what God predicted because of the bad behaviour of later generations. Now, you might not be familiar with the book of Joshua, so here's a bit of an outline. As I said, it's the beginning of the history of Israel in the homeland. And this is a history that is continuing today. So, going back a few steps, Moses had died and he handed over to Joshua. The spies were sent out, and there's an account of this woman, Rahab, who protected the spies. This is the spies in Joshua. And then they cross over the Jordan River, and they celebrate the Passover at a place called Gilgal. Then there's the account of the destruction of the city of Jericho. Then they're defeated at a place called Ai because of a guy called Achan, who kept some valuables that when that army had been told not to touch any of the valuables. Then subsequently they have another go and they do take Ai. And then the law of Moses is read out to Israel at a place called Ebal. There's some people called the Gibeonites, and through an exercise of deception, they make a treaty with the Israelites. They pretend to be from far away when they're actually close by because they have heard what God has done for the Israelites, and they are fearful of that. Chapter 10, the king of Jerusalem and a bunch of others attack the Gibeonites, and Joshua defeats them because they just made a treaty with them, so they were obligated there. There's a description of the conquest of the south, of the conquest of the north, and then there's extensive descriptions of the allotment of the territories to the different tribes. And it's the eastern tribes who had taken inheritance on the eastern side of the Jordan. They go back home. That's Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. The covenant is renewed again. This is the deal between Israelites and God. And then at the end of the book, Joshua dies. So there's an outline of the book of Joshua. A shorter outline of this is this. If you have trouble remembering all that, I'm sure that you can remember this. Two things. One is conquest. the first 12 chapters of the book is mostly about conquest. And secondly is allocation of land to the tribes. So the book is roughly divided into those two parts. Conquest, allocation. So that's an outline of Joshua. Now, as we read earlier, Joshua challenges the people about serving God. And he basically says, you do whatever you will, but as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. And further on at the end of the book in 24:31, it's noted that in fact it says, Israel served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had experienced everything the Lord had done for Israel. So the book ends on a positive note. So the takeaway again, to just reiterate this again, it's about divine judgment and it's about grace. How do we apply that to ourselves? Well, Joshua tells us about our place with God. It's about the fulfillment of a plan of God. And the plan on one hand is about purging wickedness, and on the other hand, it's about giving rest to his people. The two go together. And this is what God is like. And what we see in the book of Joshua is a reflection of God's promises in the future. God will eventually deal with all sin and wickedness. And when he does it, it won't be pretty. But the flip side is that those who are his will be given an inheritance, except that it is an allotted inheritance with him in heaven. And that's a fantastic, beautiful thing. But even in advance of that, putting our trust in God through Jesus, we enter into his rest, so to speak. And we're going to have a look at that in Hebrews 4 a bit later. So, our place with God. One of the well-known and memorable accounts in Joshua is the taking of Jericho, the walls of Jericho falling down. But how did this come about? Well, let's have a brief look at that in Joshua 5:13-15. Now, when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" "Neither," he replied. "But as the commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come." Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, "What message does my Lord have for his servant?" The commander of the Lord's army replied, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy." And Joshua did so. So this angel, commander of the army of the Lord, sometimes it's suggested that's pre-incarnate Jesus. That's a fair enough speculation. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Text doesn't really tell us. But there's one word here that is significant, I suggest. And that word is neither. And what that means is that Joshua is under God's command, not God assisting Joshua. Okay? Yes, at other times God states that he is on Israel's side and he's fighting for them, such as in chapter 10, verse 42. But there is an important overarching principle here in that one word, neither. And that is that we are on God's side, not the other way round. God was not on Joshua's side. Joshua was on God's side. God was directing proceedings. And so a point that I suggest you can take out of that is it's not a good idea to presume to co-opt God for our purposes. Instead, we should be seeing ourselves as having the privilege and of the opportunity to be under God's direction and in some small way, perhaps, be Joshua for God. So God shares the execution of his plan with his people. He says what he's planning to do. And he also allows us to fail, as is seen in the account of the city of Ai, the sin of Achan, who he disobeyed the command that the army had been given. But a key point is that regardless of people's frailties, God's plans will not be thwarted. We get to the account of Rahab and the spies. So in advance of this invasion, some spies are sent out. Now, there isn't any record that God ordered that spies be sent out, but faith is not blind. Joshua still did planning as delegated by God, even though God was in command. And there's a contrast here with the conduct of the original spies that were sent out 40 years earlier. These ones in this account, they're confident and they are professional. Now, Rahab was a prostitute, and she hid the spies from people who were looking for them. And the people would discover, oh, there's some spies that have come, we've got to find them and sort them out. So she hid the spies, and she allowed them to escape. Now, Rahab is commended for her faith, not her falsehood. She's not commended for a falsehood, she's commended for her faith. And that's mentioned in Joshua 2, 8 to 11. And she gets mentioned in Hebrews 11, 31, and also in James 2, 25. Now, the point here is that Rahab recognized and acknowledged the sovereignty of the God of the Israelites. She wasn't Israelites, but she recognized God and she acknowledged God. So the deal that was struck was that in return for protecting the spies, Rahab and her family would be spared when Jericho was destroyed. And she would mark her house with a scarlet cloth tied in the window. And there's a bit of an echo here of the Passover in this account. So when the Israelite army wiped out Jericho, they spared Rahab and her family. So a point of this is that becoming part of God's people was never totally exclusive, but it was open to anyone who had faith. Rahab had faith in the God of Israel. We'll talk a bit about miracles. Miracles feature in Joshua. And we'll talk about, there's three fairly dramatic miracles. There's the crossing of the Jordan River, described in chapters 3 and 4. There's the fall of the walls of Jericho in chapter 6. And in chapter 10, there's the account of the sun and the moon stopping. So just have a quick look at those. Crossing the Jordan. So the experience for Israel crossing the Jordan was similar to the parting of the Red Sea. The Jordan River, it was in flood, okay, so they couldn't just easily walk across. But when the priests who were carrying the ark, which is a box with a few things in it, stepped into the Jordan River, it stopped flowing and it piled up at a place upstream. Everyone crossed the river on dry ground, and as soon as the priests stepped out of the river, it started flowing again. Now, the Jordan River is known to stop flowing in this manner when there's a cliff that's undercut and it collapses into the river and temporarily dams it. But that doesn't explain the exact precise timing of things. So what we probably have here is a natural event that is under precise supernatural control. It was foretold in advance. Now, God is not a God of coincidence. Okay? God is in control. He is controlling things. Now, sometimes crossing the Jordan is used as an analogy representing death, but it's not actually really a good analogy. A better analogy might be that the crossing of the Jordan is likened to the entrance into life of fullness and blessing in Christ. It's the rest from trusting in God rather than being disobedient, like the original 10 spies, who, because of their disobedience, they never got to enter the promised land. Jericho, the walls of Jericho fell down after the army marched around it and blew trumpets. That's how the walls came down. Now, God gave detailed instructions about how to get through the defences, and that was led on from that passage that I registered a little while ago. But the plan relied totally on faith in God. Third miracle we'll talk about is the sun and the moon. In chapter 10, it describes the sun and the moon stopping. It was a battle. Now, not to take away from the miraculous, but I can comment that there are some textual indications that the original wording might in fact have meant that the sun and moon was stopped from coming out rather than going down. Okay. What Joshua might have wanted this battle was actually more darkness and not more light. Now, modern rendering, it seems to indicate that what he wanted was a longer day, whereas in actual fact, it might actually be that he wanted more night. more darkness. And so the answer to his prayer might have been the hailstorm that's mentioned in verse 11. But it's a miracle nonetheless. But there's just a little bit of background on that. God is God and he takes care of all the difficulties. Now, even if the sun and the moon did stand still, something that is not beyond God's control, what I can tell you, what is a myth is that it can be proven by computation. There's a little myth that floats around that you can compute it, and it's just not true. Okay. So what I want to talk about here is that God is God who performs miracles. And it's worthwhile to contrast these events with parables that Jesus spoke. The events of Joshua aren't parables. They aren't rhetorical or literary devices with some hidden meaning to make people think. They're pure and simple accounts of historical events. These events are not about moral truths. They are about historical truths. And for those who don't or can't properly understand the nature of God, the temptation is to explain away these accounts. And one approach that sometimes is taken is to say, oh, they're just myths. The events didn't really happen, or that there wasn't any supernatural element to them. They were just coincidental natural events that have been exaggerated. And this mythologizing the Bible, what it does is it removes the theo from theology. And people who push these sort of ideas, perhaps they really might be called Bible-ogians rather than theologians, because they've removed a divine, omnipotent God from the picture. They've removed God from the gospel. So maybe this sort of approach is to make the message more palatable to those who refuse to acknowledge an almighty, omnipotent God who demands allegiance. But whatever the reason that academics and some people in the world would want to put forward for denying these events, denying that God can and does intervene in the world in a supernatural fashion, it's not a trifling matter. It gets right to the heart of the gospel message. Either God is God or he's not. Isn't science worthwhile, you might ask? Yes. But holding the Bible up to science is a worthless pursuit if on the one side is an objective of removing God from the picture. So if you're confronted with this approach of holding the Bible up to science, of comparing these events and looking at them in the light of science, what you need to do is ask if people are trying to understand God better, or are they simply wanting to remove God from the picture? And sometimes you'll see this in television and so-called documentaries that are really thinly veiled attempts to de-God the Bible. And they focus on the difficulties and contradictions while conveniently ignoring the mountains of overwhelming archaeological evidence confirming the account of Joshua. And these so-called documentaries are worthless. Rather than trying to reveal, what they're actually trying to do is to hide. They're trying to hide God. I'll give you a bit of an analogy here. Imagine someone who turns on the lights when everyone stands up and turns them off again when everybody sits down. That's easy for us to comprehend. Now, if you remember back in Genesis, God created everything. And the first words of Genesis are, "In the beginning of God." In the beginning, God. This is the foundation. God just is. And he created everything from nothing just by speaking. So if God created everything from nothing just by speaking, then he can manipulate anything and everything. These things are easy for God. Just the same as it's easy for someone to turn the lights on when everybody stands up. So the Bible is about the history of what God did. I'm sorry, it's not about you. The Bible's not about you. It's about God. So it's about what God did, and not just about the history of Israel. It's the history of the God of Israel. And Joshua is about real places, real people, real events, and a real God. The conquest. Chapter 11, verse 20. For it was the Lord himself who hardened their hearts to wage war against Israel, so that he might destroy them totally, exterminating them without mercy, as the Lord had commanded Moses. What had the Canaanites done wrong? Well, the Canaanites were doing everything that God had said not to do, in all the ugliness of it. We're not going to go into those details. Now, the army of Israel go into the promised land and proceed to wipe out the towns of the region. So what do we make of this? Well, the key point is that the conquest is all about God's holiness. Back in Genesis 19, we can read about how God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah in supernatural fashion rather than through human agents. Joshua is about Israel as God's instrument of destruction. And it's pretty confronting stuff. Yes, it's genocide. And trying convoluted reasoning to avoid the genocide as being from God is of no use. The fact is, of the matter is that God can't stand wickedness. God is incredibly patient, far beyond human timescales. But when he decides to deal with what he hates, he is emphatic and decisive. He deals with it by destroying it. And if you're tempted to think that all of this is in the past and God no longer does this sort of thing, then note that in the end, the whole earth will be destroyed. And what God is doing is destroying wickedness. And he does this because he is holy, set apart. Now, I'll give you a little bit of analogy. Don't take this analogy too far, but it's a little bit like how a lot of otherwise bad things had to happen during the Second World War to defeat the Nazis. Yet the consequences of failing to stop the Nazis are unthinkable. To not pursue available means to stop them would have been to be complicit in great evil. God is right to do whatever he says is right, and God will not be complicit with evil. Now, I have to say that Jesus didn't usher in a time of human military action on behalf of God. Quite the opposite. If you read through the Gospels, that's quite clear. It is quite the opposite. And so what can be expected is that when God acts in the future to destroy wickedness, it will most likely, I suggest, be in a supernatural manner, more like Sodom and Gomorrah than the conquest of Canaan. But the end result is the same. So that's the conquest. That's one half of the picture. The other half of the picture is the rest. I'm just going to talk briefly about that. So at the end, the scripture records that at the end of chapter 14, it's recorded that then the land had rest from war. So the fulfillment of God's promise is rest. And we're going to have a look at Hebrews chapter 4, verses 1 to 11. Therefore, since the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us be careful that none of you be found to have fallen short of it. For we also have had the good news proclaimed to us, just as they did. But the message they heard was of no value to them, because they did not share the faith of those who obeyed. Now we who have believed enter that rest, just as God has said. So I declared on oath my anger, they shall never enter my rest. And yet his work has been finished since the creation of the world. For somewhere he has spoken about the seventh day in these words, on the seventh day God rested from all his work. And again in the passage above he says, they shall never enter my rest. Therefore, since it still remains for some to enter that rest, and since those who formerly had the good news proclaimed to them did not go in because of their disobedience, God again set a certain day, calling it today. This he did when a long time later he spoke through David, as in the message already quoted, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken later about another day. There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For those who enter God's rest also rest from their own work, just as God did from his. Let us therefore make every effort to enter that rest, so that no one will perish by following their example of disobedience. So our objective as Christians is to enter into God's rest. Joshua and Caleb had the privilege of entering the promised land because they trusted in God and what he would do. They entered into the rest. So the summary and the conclusions of all of this. Jumping back, Exodus is about deliverance from bondage. Joshua is about victory, possession, and rest. God has various plans at various times for various purposes. And Joshua and Israel saw the awesome power of God in action as they submitted to his will. Think about what can happen if we submit to God's will, regardless of whether or not we comprehend the plan. We might not necessarily understand the plan that's behind it, but if we're submitting to God's will, we can see God's power at work. So giving rest and blessing was part of God's will for Israel. Our part, or your part, to play might be in some way that seems from worldly perspective to be small, or it might be on a grand scale like Joshua. Just be open to what God might be wanting to do. He has plans, and you can just be open to being part of them. So again, the main takeaway from Joshua is divine judgment and grace. And Joshua tells us about our place with God. It's about the fulfillment of a plan of God. And the plan, on the one hand, is about purging wickedness, and on the other hand, is about giving rest to his people. And our response to all of this should be like that of Joshua in 24:15. As for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you that through Jesus we can enter into your rest.